You'd probably be surprised at what we would understand, Tenedra, Mr. Wolf told her.
I'm accustomed to being addressed as my lady, or as your highness.
And I am accustomed to being told the truth.
I thought you were in charge,
Tenedra said to Silk.
Appearances are deceiving, Silk observed blandly. I would answer the question.
It's an old treaty. I didn't sign it. So I don't see why I should be bound by it. I'm supposed to present myself in the throne room at Riva on my 16th birthday.
We know that, Barak said impatiently. What's the problem?
I'm not going, that's all, Tenedra announced. I won't go to Riva, and no one can make me go. The queen in the Wood of the Dryads is my kinswoman, and she will give me sanctuary.
Jeebers had partially recovered.
What have you done? He demanded, aghast. I undertook this with a clear understanding that I would be rewarded, even promoted. You have put my head on the block, you little idiot!
Jeebers!
She cried, shocked at his words.
Let's get off the road a ways, Silk suggested. We've obviously got quite a bit to discuss, and we are likely to be interrupted here on the main highway.
Probably a good idea, Wolf agreed. Let's find some quiet place and set up for the night. We will decide what we are going to do, and then we can start out fresh in the morning.
They remounted and rode across the rolling fields toward a line of trees that marked the course of a winding country lane about a mile away.
How about there?
Durnick suggested, pointing at a broad oak which stood beside the lane, its branches beginning to leaf out in the late afternoon sunlight.
That should do, Wolf said.
It was pleasant in the dappled shade beneath the spreading limbs of the oak. The lane was lined with low stone walls, mossy and cool. A stile stepped over one of the walls just there, and a path meandered across the field from it toward a nearby pond sparkling in the sun.
They'd put fire down behind one of the walls, Durnick said. It won't be seen from the main road that way.
I'll get some wood,
Garion volunteered, looking at the dead limbs littering the grass beneath the tree. They had, by now, established a sort of routine in the setting up of a night's encampment. The tents were erected, the horses watered and picketed, and the fire was started all within the space of an hour. Then Durnick, who had noticed a few telltale circles on the surface of the pond, heated an iron pin in the fire and carefully hammered it into a hook.
"What's that for?" Garion asked him.
"Oh, I thought some fish might be good for supper,"
the smith said, wiping the hook on the skirt of his leather tunic. He laid it aside then and lifted a second pin out of the fire with a pair of tongs.
"Would you like to try your luck, too?"
Garion grinned at him. Barak had stood nearby, combing the snarls out of his beard. He looked up rather wistfully.
"I don't suppose you'd have time to make another hook, would you?"
Durnick chuckled.
"It only takes a couple minutes."
"We'll need bait,"
Barak said, getting up quickly.
"Where's your spade?"
Not long afterward, the three of them crossed the field to the pond, cut some saplings for poles, and settled down to serious fishing. The fish, it appeared, were ravenous, and attacked the worm-baited hooks in schools. Within the space of an hour, nearly two dozen respectable-sized trout lay in a gleaming row on the grassy bank of the pond. Aunt Paul inspected their catch gravely when they returned as the sky turned rosy overhead with the setting of the sun.
"Very nice. But you forgot to clean them."
"Oh,"
Barak said. He looked slightly pained.
"We thought that... Well, what I mean is, as long as we caught them..."
He left it hanging.
"Go on,"
she said with a level gaze.
Barak sighed. "I guess we had better clean them,"
he regretfully told Durnick and Garion.
"You're probably right, then," Durnick agreed.
The sky had turned purple with evening, and the stars had begun to come out when they sat down to eat. Aunt Paul had fried the trout to a crisp golden brown, and even the sulky little princess found nothing to complain about as she ate. After they had finished, they set aside their plates and took up the problem of Tenedra and her flight from Tol Hanath. Jeebers had sunk into such abject melancholy that he could offer little to the discussion. Sinedra adamantly announced that even if they were to turn her over to the Baroons in the city, she would run away again. In the end, they reached no conclusion.
We're in trouble, no matter what we do, Silk summed it up ruefully. Even if we try to deliver her to her family, there are bound to be some embarrassing questions. And I am sure that she can be counted on to invent a colorful story that will put us in the worst possible light.
We can talk about it some more in the morning,
Aunt Paul said, her placid tone indicating that she had already made up her mind about something, but she did not elaborate. Shortly before midnight, Jeebers made his escape. They were all awakened by the thudding of his horse's hooves as the panic-stricken tutor fled at a gallop toward the walls of Tol Barun. Silk stood in the flickering light of the dying fire, his face angry.
"Why didn't you stop him?"
he asked Tetar, who had been standing watch.
"I was told not to,"
the leather-clad Elgar said with a glance at Aunt Paul. "It solves the only real problem we had," Aunt Paul explained. "The schoolmaster would only have been excess baggage."
"You knew that he was going to run away?"
Silk asked. "Naturally. I helped him to arrive at the decision. He will go straight to the Baroons and try to save his own skin by informing them that the princess ran away from the palace on her own, and that we have her now."
"You have to stop him, then,"
Sinedra said in a ringing voice.
"Go! Go after him! Bring him back!"
"After all the trouble I went to persuading him to leave?"
"Oh, don't be so foolish," Aunt Paul answered.
"How dare you speak to me like that?"
Sinedra demanded.
"You seem to forget who I am."
"Young lady," Silk said urbanely, "I think that you would be amazed at how little Polgara is concerned about who you are."
"Polgara?"
Sinedra faltered.
"The Polgara? I thought you said that she was your sister."
"I lied," Silk confessed. "It's a vice that I have."
"You're not an ordinary merchant?"
the girl accused him.
"He is Prince Keldar of Dresnia," Aunt Paul said. "The others have a similar eminence. I am sure you can see how little your title impresses us. We have our own titles, so we know how empty they are."
If you were Polgara, well, then he must be..."
The princess turned to stare at Mr. Wolf, who had seated himself on the lowest step of the stile to pull on his shoes.
"Yes," Aunt Paul said. "He doesn't really look the part now, does he?"
"What are you doing in Tolnedra?"
Sinedra asked in a stunned voice.
"Are you going to use magic of some kind to control the outcome of the succession?"
"Why should we?"
Mr. Wolf said, getting to his feet.
"Tolnedrans always seem to think that their politics shake the whole world. But the rest of the world's really not all that concerned about who gains the throne in Tol Honoth. We are here on a matter of much greater urgency."
He looked off into the darkness in the direction of Tol Barun.
"It will take Jeebers a certain amount of time to convince the people in the city that he's not a lunatic. But it would probably be a good idea if we left the area. I imagine we had better stay away from the main highway."
"That's no problem," Silk assured him.
"And what about me?"
Sinedra asked.
"You wanted to go to the Wood of the Dryads," Aunt Paul told her. "We were going in that direction anyway, so you will stay with us. We will see what Queen Xantha says when we get you there."
"Am I to consider myself a prisoner, then?"
the princess asked stiffly.
"You can. It makes you feel better, dear," Aunt Paul said.
She looked at the tiny girl critically in the flickering firelight.
"I'm going to have to do something about your hair, though. What did you use for dye? It looks awful."
Chapter 19. They moved rapidly south for the next few days, traveling frequently at night to avoid the mounted patrols of legionnaires who were beating the countryside in their efforts to locate Sinedra.
"Maybe we should have hung on to Jeebers,"
Barak muttered sourly after one near brush with the soldiers.
"He's roused every garrison from here to the border.
It might have been better to have dropped him off in some isolated place or something.
That or something has a certain ring of finality to it, old friend, Silk said with a sharp little grin.
Barak shrugged. It's a solution to a problem,
Silk laughed. You really should try not to let your knife do all of your thinking for you. That's the one quality we find least attractive in our Cherrick cousins.
And we find this compulsion to make clever remarks, which seems to overwhelm our Drasnian brothers now and then, almost equally unattractive,
Barak told him coolly.
Oh, nicely put, Silk said, with mock admiration.
They rode on, watchful, always ready to hide or to run. During those days, they relied heavily on Hetar's curious ability. Since the patrols searching for them were inevitably mounted, the tall, hawk-faced Algar swept their surroundings with his mind, searching for horses. The warnings he could thus provide usually gave them sufficient notice of the approach of the patrols.
What is it like?
Geryon asked him one cloudy mid-morning, as they rode along a seldom-used and weed-grown track to which Silk had led them.
I mean, being able to hear a horse's thoughts.
I don't think I can describe it exactly, Hetar answered. I have always been able to do it, so I cannot imagine what it is like not doing it. There is a kind of reaching out in a horse's mind, a sort of inclusiveness. A horse seems to think we instead of I. I suppose it is because in their natural condition, they are members of a herd. After they get to know you, they think of you as a herd mate. Sometimes they even forget that you are not a horse.
He broke off suddenly.
Belgarath, he announced sharply. There's another patrol coming, just beyond that hill over there. 20 or 30 of them.
Mr. Wolf looked about quickly.
Have we got time to reach those trees?
He pointed at a thick stand of scrub maple about a half mile ahead.
If we hurry. Then run,
Wolf ordered, and they all kicked their horses into a sudden burst of speed. They reached the trees just as the first few raindrops of the spring shower that had been threatening all morning pattered onto the broad leaves. They dismounted and pushed in among the springy saplings, worming their way back out of sight, leading their horses. The Tolnedrun patrol came over the hilltop and swept down into the shallow valley. The captain in charge of the legionnaires pulled in his horse not far from the stand of maples and dispersed his men with a series of sharp commands. They moved out in small groups, scouting the weedy road in both directions and surveying the surrounding countryside from the top of the next rise. The officer, and a civilian in a gray riding cloak, remained behind, sitting their horses beside the track. The captain squinted distastefully up into the sprinkling rain.
"It is going to be a wet day," he said, dismounting, and pulling his crimson cloak tighter around him.
His companion also swung down and turned so that the party hiding among the maples was able to see his face. Geryon felt Hetar tense suddenly. The man in the cloak was a Murgo.
"Over here, Captain,"
the Murgo said, leading his horse into the shelter provided by the outspreading limbs of the saplings at the edge of the stand. The Tolnedrin nodded and followed the man in the riding cloak.
"Have you had the chance to think over my offer?"
"I thought it was only speculation," the captain replied.
"We don't even know that these foreigners are in this quadrant."
"My information is that they are going south, Captain. I think you can be quite certain that they are somewhere in your quadrant."
"There's no guarantee that we will find them, though. And even if we do, it would be very difficult to do what you propose."
"Captain,"
the Murgo explained patiently,
"it is for the safety of the princess, after all. If she has returned to Tol Hanath, the Vorduvians are going to kill her. You have read those documents I brought you."
"She will be safe with the Varuns. The Vorduvians aren't going to come into southern Tolnedra after her."
The Baroons are only going to turn her over to her father. You are a Baroon yourself. Would you defy an emperor of your own house?
The captain's face was troubled.
Her only hope of safety is with the Horbites.
What guarantees do I have that she will be safe with them?
Oh, the best guarantee of all. Politics. The Horbites are doing everything in their power to block the Grand Duke Kedor on his march to the throne. Since he wants the princess dead, the Horbites naturally want to keep her alive. It is the only way, really, to ensure her safety. And you'll become a wealthy man in the process.
He jingled a heavy purse suggestively. The captain still looked doubtful.
Suppose we double the amount,
the Murgo said in a voice that almost purred. The captain swallowed hard.
It is for her safety, isn't it?
Of course it is.
It's not as if I were betraying the House of Borun.
You are a patriot, Captain,
the Murgo assured the officer, with a cold smile. Aunt Paul was holding Senedra's arm quite firmly as they crouched together among the trees. The tiny girl's face was outraged, and her eyes were blazing. Later, after the legionnaires and their Murgo friend had departed, the princess exploded.
How dare they?
She raged.
And for money.
That's Telnedrin politics for you, Silk said, as they led their horses out of the stand of saplings into the drizzly morning.
But he is a Baroon,
she protested.
A member of my own family.
Telnedrin's first loyalty is to his purse, Silk told her.
I am surprised that you haven't discovered that by now, Your Highness. A few days later, they topped a hill and saw the wood of the dryads spreading like a green smudge on the horizon. The showers had blown off, and the sun was very bright.
We will be safe once we reach the wood,
the princess told them.
The legions will not follow us there.
What's to stop them? Garion asked her.
The treaty with the dryads. Do you not know anything?
Garion resented that remark.
There's no one about, Hetar reported to Mr. Wolf. We can go slow, or wait for dark.
Let's make a run for it. I'm getting tired of dodging patrols.
They started down the hill at a gallop toward the forest lying ahead of them. There seemed to be none of the usual brushy margin which usually marked the transition from fields to woodlands. The trees simply began. When Wolf led them beneath those trees, the change was as abrupt as if they had suddenly gone inside a house. The wood itself was a forest of incredible antiquity. The great oaks spread so broadly that the sky was almost never visible. The forest floor was mossy and cool, and there was very little undergrowth. It seemed to Garion that they were all quite tiny under the vast trees, and there was a strange, hushed quality about the woods. The air was very still, and there was a hum of insects, and from far overhead, a chorus of birdsong.
Strange, Durnick said, looking around. I don't see any sign of woodcutters.
Woodcutters?
Senedra gasped.
In here? They would not dare come into this wood.
The wood is inviolate, Durnick, Mr. Wolf explained. The Baroon family has a treaty with the Dryads. No one has touched a tree here for over 3,000 years.
Ah, this is a curious place,
Mandarallan said, looking around a bit uncomfortably.
Methinks I feel a presence here. A presence not altogether friendly.
The wood is alive,
Senedra told him.
It doesn't really like strangers, but don't worry, Mandarallan. You are safe as long as you are with me.
She sounded quite smug about it.
Are you sure the patrols won't follow us? Durnick asked. Jeebrus knew we were coming here after all, and I'm sure he told the Baroons.
The Baroons won't violate their treaty with the Dryads. Not for any reason, Wolf assured him.
I have never known of a treaty that its own Nedrin would not step around if it was to his advantage, Silk spoke skeptically.
This one is a bit different. The Dryads gave one of their princesses to a young noble of the House of Barun. She became the mother of the Emperor of the First Barun Dynasty. The fortunes of the Baruns are very intimately tied up in the treaty. They are not going to gamble with that, not for any reason.
What exactly is a Dryad?
Garion asked. The strange sense of a presence, an awareness in the wood, made him want to talk to cover the oppressive, watchful silence.
A small group, quite gentle. I've always rather liked them. They aren't human, of course, said Mr. Wolf, but that's not all that important.
I'm a Dryad,
Tenedra said rather proudly. Garion stared at her.
Technically, she's right. The Dryad line seems to breed true on the female side of the House of Barun. That's one of the things that keeps the family honest about the treaty. All those wives and mothers who'd pack up and leave, if it were ever broken.
She looks human, Garion objected, still staring at the princess.
The Dryads are so closely related to humans that the differences are hardly significant, said Wolf. That probably explains why they didn't go mad like the other monsters did when Torak cracked the world.
Monsters?
Tenedra protested loudly.
Your pardon, princess. It is an Ulgo term, used to describe the non-humans, who supported Gorum at Krogu when he met with the god Ul.
Do I look like a monster to you?
She demanded, tossing her head angrily.
A poor choice of words, perhaps. Forgive me.
Monsters, indeed.
Wolf shrugged.
There's a stream not far ahead, if I remember right. We will stop there and wait until word of our arrival reaches Queen Xantha. It is not a good idea to go into the territory of the Dryads without the Queen's permission. They can get quite nasty if they are provoked.
I thought you said they were gentle, Durnek said.
Within reason. But it's not a good idea to irritate people who communicate with trees when you are in the middle of the forest. Unpleasant things have a way of happening. He frowned. It reminds me. You had better stow your axe away out of sight. Dryads have strong feelings about axes and fires. They're most unreasonable about fire. We'll have to keep our fire small and only for cooking.
They rode in under a colossal oak beside a sparkling stream purling over mossy rocks, dismounted and set up their dun-colored tents. After they had eaten, Garion wandered around feeling bored. Mr. Wolf was napping, and Silk had lured the others into a dice game. Aunt Paul had seated the princess on a log and was stripping the purple dye from her hair.
If you don't have anything else to do, Garion, why don't you go bathe? Bathe? Where? I'm sure you'll find a pool somewhere along the stream, she said, carefully lathering Tenedra's hair. You want me to bathe in that water? Aren't you afraid I'll catch cold? You're a healthy boy, dear, but a very dirty one. Now go wash.
Garion gave her a dark look and went to one of the packs for clean clothing, soap, and a towel. Then he stamped off upstream, grumbling at every step. Once he was alone under the trees, he felt even more strongly that a peculiar sense of being watched was about. It was not anything definable. There seemed to be nothing specific about it, but rather, it felt as if the oaks themselves were aware of him, and were passing information about his movements among themselves with a kind of vegetative communication he could not begin to understand. There seemed to be no menace in it, merely a kind of watchfulness. Some distance from the tents, he found a fairly large pool where the stream dropped in a waterfall from the rocks above. The water in the pool was very clear, and he could see the bright pebbles on the bottom and several large trout that eyed him warily. He tested the water with his hand and shuddered. He considered subterfuge, a quick splashing of water on his body, and a bit of soap on the more obvious smudges. But on reflection, he gave up the notion. Aunt Paul would settle for nothing less than a complete bath. He sighed bitterly and began to take off his clothing. The first shock was awful, but after a few minutes he found that he could bear it. In a short time it even became exhilarating. The waterfall provided a convenient means for rinsing off the soap, and before long he found that he was actually enjoying himself.
"You're making an awful lot of noise," Senedra
said, standing on the bank and appraising him quite calmly. Garion immediately dove to the bottom of the pool. Unless one is a fish, however, one can hardly remain underwater indefinitely. After about a minute, he struggled to the surface and popped his head out of the water, gasping and sputtering.
"Whatever are you doing?"
Senedra asked. She was wearing a short white tunic, sleeveless and belted at the waist, and open sandals with laces that crisscrossed her slender ankles and calves and tied just below her knees. She carried a towel in one hand.
Go away,"
Garion spluttered.
"Oh, don't be so silly,"
she said, sitting down on a large stone and beginning to unlace her sandals. Her coppery hair was still damp and tumbled in a heavy mass about her shoulders.
"What are you doing?"
"I want to bathe. Are you going to be much longer?"
"Go someplace else,"
Garion cried, starting to shiver but remaining determinedly crouched over in the water with only his head sticking out.
"This place looks just fine. How's the water?" Cold, he chattered. "But I'm not coming out until you go away."
"Oh, don't be such a ninny,"
she told him. He shook his head stubbornly, his face flaming. She sighed with exasperation.
"Oh, very well. I won't look. But I think you're being very silly. At the baths in Tolhanath, no one thinks anything at all about such things."
This isn't Tolhanath," he told her pointedly.
"I'll turn my back if that will make you feel better,"
she said it, getting up and standing with her back toward the pool. Not entirely trusting her, Garion crept from the pool and, still dripping, jerked on his drawers and hose.
"All right," he called. "You can have the pool now."
He mopped at his streaming face and hair with his towel.
"I'm going back to the tents."
"The Lady Pagara says that you are to stay with me,"
she said, calmly untying the cord about her waist.
"Aunt Paul said what?"
he demanded, terribly shocked.
"You are supposed to stay with me to protect me."
She took hold of the hem of her tunic, obviously preparing to take it off. Garion spun about and stared determinedly at the Trigis. His ears flamed and his hands trembled uncontrollably. She laughed, a small silvery laugh, and he could hear splashing as she entered the pool. She squealed from the shock of the cold water, and then there was more splashing.
"Bring me the soap,"
she commanded. Without thinking, he bent to pick up the soap and caught one brief glimpse of her standing waist-deep in the water before he shut his eyes tightly. He backed toward the pool, his eyes closed and the hand holding the soap thrust out awkwardly behind him. She laughed again and took the soap from his hand. After what seemed an eternity, the princess completed her bath, emerged from the pool, dried herself, and put her clothes back on. Garion kept his eyes firmly shut the entire time.
"You Sindars have such a curious notions,"
she said, as they sat together in the sun-warmed glade beside the pool. She was combing her deep red hair, her head inclined to one side and the comb pulling down through the thick, damp tangles.
"The baths in Tolhanath are open to all, and athletic contests are always conducted without clothing. Just last summer I myself ran against a dozen other girls in the Imperial Stadium. Their spectators were most appreciative."
"I can imagine," Garion said dryly.
"What's that?"
she asked, pointing at the amulet resting against his bare chest.
"My grandfather gave it to me last Eristide,"
Garion answered.
"Let me see."
She held out her hand. He leaned forward.
"Take it off so I can see it,"
she ordered.
"I'm not supposed to take it off. Mr. Wolf and Aunt Paul say I'm never supposed to take it off for any reason. I think there's a spell of some kind on it."
What a strange idea,
she remarked, as she bent to examine the amulet.
They aren't really sorcerers, are they?
Mr. Wolf is 7,000 years old. He knew the god Alder. I've seen him make a tree grow from a small twig in a matter of minutes and set rocks on fire. Aunt Paul cured a blind woman with a single word, and she can turn herself into an owl.
I do not believe in such things. I'm sure there's another explanation.
Garion shrugged and pulled on his linen shirt and brown tunic. He shook his head and raked his fingers through his still damp hair.
You're making an awful mess of it,
she observed critically.
Here.
She stood up and stepped behind him.
Let me do it.
She put the comb to his hair and began pulling it through carefully.
You have nice hair for a man.
It's just hair, he said indifferently. She combed in silence for a moment or two, then took his chin in her hand, turned his head, and looked at him critically. She touched his hair at the sides a time or two until it was arranged to her satisfaction.
That's better.
Thank you. He was a bit confused by the change in her. She sat down again on the grass, clasped her arms around one knee, and gazed at the sparkling pool.
Garion?
She said finally.
Yes. What is it like to grow up as an ordinary person?
He shrugged.
I've never been anything but ordinary, so I wouldn't know what to compare it to.
You know what I mean. Tell me about where you grew up and what you did and all.
So he told her about Faldur's farm, about the kitchen and Durnik's smithy, and Dorun and Rundrig and Zubret.
You are in love with Zubret, aren't you?
She asked it almost accusingly.
I thought I was. But so much has happened since we left the farm that sometimes I can't even remember what she looks like. I think I could do without being in love anyway. From what I've seen of it, it's pretty painful most of the time.
You are impossible,
she said, and then she smiled at him, her little face framed in the blazing mass of her sun-touched hair.
Probably. All right, now, you tell me what it's like to grow up as a very special person.
Well, but I'm not that special.
You're an imperial princess, he reminded her. I'd call that pretty special.
Oh, that, she said, then giggled. You know, sometimes since I joined you people, I almost forget that I'm an imperial princess.
Almost, he said with a smile, but not quite.
No,
she agreed,
not quite.
She looked out across the pool again.
Most of the time being a princess is very boring. It is all ceremonies and formalities. You have to stand around most of the time listening to speeches or receiving state visitors. There are guards around all the time, but some of the times I sneak away so I can be myself. It makes them furious.
She giggled again, and then her gaze turned pensive.
Let me tell your fortune,
she said, taking his hand.
Can you tell fortunes?
It's only make-believe,
she admitted.
My maids and I play at it sometimes. We all promise each other high-born husbands and many children.
She turned his hand over and looked at it. The silvery mark on his palm was very plain now, and the skin was clean.
Whatever is that?
I don't know.
It's not a disease, is it?
No. It's always been there. I think it's got something to do with my family. Aunt Paul doesn't like to have people see it for some reason, so she tries to keep it hidden.
How could you hide something like that?
She finds things for me to do that keep my hands dirty most of the time.
How strange,
she said.
I have a birthmark, too, right over my heart. Would you like to see it?
She took hold of the neck of her tunic.
I'll take your word for it,
Garion told her, blushing furiously. She laughed, a silvery, tinkling little laugh.
You're a very strange boy, Garion. You are not at all like the other boys I've met.
They were Tolnedrins, probably,
Garion pointed out.
I'm a Sindar. Or at least that's the way I was raised. So there are bound to be differences.
You sound as if you are not sure what you are.
Well, Silk says I'm not a Sindar. He says he's not sure exactly what I am, and that's very odd. Silk can recognize anybody for what he is immediately. Your father thought I was Riven.
Since the Lady Polgra is your aunt and Dalgarath's your grandfather, You are probably a sorcerer,
Zenedra observed. Garion laughed.
Me? Oh, that's silly. Besides, the sorcerers aren't a race, not like the Kerix or Tolnedrons or Rivens. It's more like a profession, I think. Sort of like being a lawyer or a merchant. Only there aren't any new ones. The sorcerers are all thousands of years old. Mr. Wolf says that maybe people have changed in some way, so they can't become sorcerers anymore.
Tenedra had leaned back and was resting on her elbows, looking up at him.
Garion?
Yes?
Would you like to kiss me?
Garion's heart started to pound. Then Durnick's voice called to them from not far away, and for one flaming instant, Garion hated his old friend. Chapter 20
Mistress Paul says it's time for you two to come back to the tents, Durnick told them when he reached the glade.
There was a faint hint of amusement on his plain, dependable face, and he looked knowingly at the two of them. Garion blushed and then grew angry with himself for blushing. Tenedra, however, showed no concern at all.
Has the dryads come yet?
She asked, getting to her feet and brushing the grass from the back of her tunic.
Not yet, Durnick answered. Wolf says that they should find us soon. Seems to be some kind of a storm building up the south, and Mistress Paul thought the two of you ought to come back.
Garion glanced at the sky and saw a layer of inky clouds moving up from the south, staining the bright blue sky as they rolled ponderously northward. He frowned.
I've never seen clouds like that, have you, Durnick?
Durnick looked up.
Strange, he agreed.
Garion rolled up the two wet towels, and they started back down the stream. The clouds blotted out the sun, and the woods became suddenly very dark. The sense of watchfulness was still there, that wary awareness they had all felt since they had entered the wood. But now there was something else as well. The great trees stirred uneasily, and a million tiny messages seemed to pass among the rustling leaves.
They are afraid,
Zenedra whispered.
Something is frightening them.
What?
Durnick asked.
The trees, they're afraid of something. Can't you feel it?
He stared at her in perplexity. Far above them, the birds suddenly fell silent, and a chill breeze began to blow, carrying with it a foul reek of stagnant water and rotting vegetation.
What is that smell?
Garion asked, looking about nervously.
Nice as south of here,
Zenedra said.
It's mostly swamps.
Is it that close?
Garion asked.
Not really,
she said with a small frown.
It must be 60 leagues or more.
Would a smell carry that far?
It's not likely,
Durnick said.
At least it wouldn't be in Sindaria.
How far is it to the tents?
Zenedra asked.
About half a mile, Durnick answered.
Maybe we should run,
she suggested. Durnick shook his head.
Ground's uneven. Running in a bad light's dangerous. We can walk a bit faster, though.
They hurried on through the gathering gloom. The wind began to blow harder, and the trees trembled and bent with its force. The strange fear that seemed to permeate the wood grew stronger.
There's something moving over there,
Garion whispered urgently, and pointed at the dark trees on the other side of the stream.
I don't see anything,
Zenedra said.
There, just beyond the tree with a large white limb. Is it a dryad?
A vague shape slid from one tree to another in the half-light. There was something chillingly wrong with the figure. Zenedra stared at it with revulsion.
It's not a dryad, she said. It is something alien.
Durnick picked up a fallen limb and gripped it like a cudgel with both hands. Garion looked quickly around and saw another limb. He, too, armed himself. Another figure shambled between the two trees, a bit closer this time.
We'll have to chance it, Durnick said grimly. Be careful, but run. Get the others. Now, go.
Garion took Zenedra's hand, and they started to run along the stream bank, stumbling often. Durnick lagged farther and farther behind, his two-handed club swinging warningly about him. The figures were now all around them, and Garion felt the first surges of panic. Then Zenedra screamed. One of the figures had risen from behind a low bush directly in front of them. It was large and ill-shaped, and there was no face on the front of its head. Two eye-holes stared vacantly as it shambled forward with its half-formed hands reaching out for them. The entire figure was a dark gray mud color, and it was covered with rotting, stinking moss that adhered to its oozing body. Without thinking, Geryon thrust Tenedra behind him and leaped to the attack. The first blow of his club struck the creature solidly in the side, and the club merely sank into the body with no visible effect. One of the outstretched hands touched his face, and he recoiled from that slimy touch with revulsion. Desperately, he swung again and struck the thing solidly on the forearm. With horror, he saw the arm break off at the elbow. The creature paused to pick up the still-moving arm. Tenedra screamed again, and Geryon spun about. Another of the mud men had come up behind her and had grasped her about the waist with both arms. It was starting to turn, lifting the struggling princess from the ground, when Geryon swung his club with all of his might. The blow was not aimed at head or back, but rather at the ankles. The mud man toppled backward with both of its feet broken off. Its grip about Tenedra's waist, however, did not loosen as it fell. Geryon jumped forward, discarding his club and drawing his dagger. The substance of the thing was surprisingly tough. Vines and dead twigs were encased in the clay which gave it its shape. Feverishly, Geryon cut away one of the arms and then tried to pull the screaming princess free. The other arm still clung to her. Almost sobbing with the need to hurry, Geryon started hacking at the remaining arm.
"Look out!" Tenedra shrieked. "Behind you!"
Geryon looked quickly over his shoulder. The first mudman was reaching for him. He felt a cold grip about his ankle. The arm he had just severed had inched its way across the ground and grasped him.
"Geryon!"
Barak's voice roared from a short distance.
"Over here! Hurry!"
There was a crashing in the bushes, and the great red-bearded Cherok appeared, sword in hand, with Hetar and Mandaralan close behind. With a mighty swing, Barak cut off the head of the first mudman. It sailed through the air and landed with a sickening thump several yards away. The headless creature turned and groped blindly, trying to put its hands on its attacker. Barak paled visibly, and then chopped away both outstretched arms. Still, the thing shambled forward.
"The legs!"
Geryon said quickly. He bent and hacked at the clay hand about his ankle. Barak lopped off the mudman's legs, and the thing fell. The dismembered pieces crawled toward him. Other mud men had appeared, and Hetar and Mandaralan were laying about them with their swords, filling the air with chunks and pieces of living clay. Barak bent and ripped away the remaining arm which held Tenedra. Then he jerked the girl to her feet and thrust her at Geryon.
"Get her back to the tents. Where's Durnik?"
"He stayed behind to hold them off."
"We'll go help him. Run!"
Tenedra was hysterical, and Geryon had to drag her to the tents.
"What is it?"
Aunt Paul demanded.
"Monsters, out there in the woods,"
Geryon said, pushing Tenedra at her.
"They're made out of mud and you can't kill them. They've got Durnik."
He dove into one of the tents and emerged a second later with his sword in his hand and fire in his brain.
"Geryon,"
Aunt Paul shouted, trying to disentangle herself from the sobbing princess. "What are you doing?"
"I've got to help Durnik."
"You stay where you are."
"No, Durnik's my friend."
He dashed back toward the fight, brandishing his sword.
"Geryon, come back here!"
He ignored her and ran through the dark woods. The fray was raging about 100 yards from the tents. Barak, Hetar, and Mandaralan were systematically chopping the slime-covered mudmen into chunks, and Silk darted in and out of the melee, his short sword leaving great gaping holes in the thick, moss-covered monsters. Geryon plunged into the fight, his ears ringing and a kind of desperate exultation surging through him. And then Mr. Wolf and Aunt Paul were there, with Tenedra hovering ashen-faced and trembling behind them. Wolf's eyes blazed, and he seemed to tower over them all as he gathered his will. He thrust one hand forward, palm up.
"Fire!"
he commanded, and a sizzling bolt of lightning shot upward from his hand into the whirling clouds overhead. The earth trembled with the violence of the shattering thunderclap. Geryon reeled at the force of the roaring in his mind. Aunt Paul raised her hand.
"Water,"
she said in a powerful voice. The clouds burst open, and rain fell so heavily that it seemed that the air itself had turned to water. The mud men, still mindlessly stumbling forward, began to ooze and dissolve in the thundering downpour. With a kind of sick fascination, Geryon watched them disintegrate into sodden lumps of slime and rotten vegetation, surging and heaving as the pounding rain destroyed them. Barak reached forward with his dripping sword and tentatively poked at the shapeless lump of clay that had been the head of one of their attackers. The lump broke apart, and a coiled snake unwound from its center. It raised itself as if to strike, and Barak chopped it in two. Other snakes began to appear as the mud which had encased them dissolved in the roaring deluge. "That one," Aunt Paul said, pointing at a dull green reptile struggling to free itself from the clay. "Fetch it for me, Geryon."
"Me?"
Geryon gasped, his flesh crawling.
"I'll do it," Silk said.
He picked up a forked stick and pinned the snake's head down with it. Then he carefully took hold of the wet skin at the back of the serpent's neck and lifted the twisting reptile.
"Bring it here,"
Aunt Paul ordered, wiping the water from her face. Silk carried the snake to her and held it out. The forked tongue flickered nervously, and the dead eyes fixed on her.
"What does this mean?" she demanded of the snake.
The serpent hissed at her. Then, in a voice that was a sibilant whisper, it replied,
"That, Pulgara, is the affair of my mistress."
Silk's face blanched as the dripping snake spoke, and he tightened his grip.
"I see," Aunt Paul said.
"Abandon this search,"
the snake hissed.
"My mistress will allow you to go no further."
Aunt Paul laughed scornfully.
"Allow? Your mistress hasn't the power to allow me anything."
"My mistress is the Queen of Nysa,"
the snake said in its whispering hiss.
"Her power there is absolute. The ways of the serpent are not the ways of men, and my mistress is Queen of the Serpents. You will enter Nysa at your own peril. We are patient and not afraid. We will wait where you are least to expect us. Our sting is a small injury, scarce noted, but it is death."
"What is Salmisra's interest in this matter?"
Aunt Paul asked. The serpent's flickering tongue darted at her.
"She has chosen not to reveal that to me, and it is not in my nature to be curious. I have delivered my message and already received my reward. Now do with me as you wish."
"Very well,"
Aunt Paul said. She looked coldly at the snake, her face streaming in the heavy rain.
"Shall I kill it?"
Silk asked, his face set and his fingers white-knuckled from the strain of holding the thick, coiling reptile.
"No," she said quietly. "There's no point in destroying so excellent a messenger."
She fixed the snake with a flinty look.
"Return with these others to Salmisra. Tell her that if she interferes again, I will come after her, and the deepest slime pit in all Nysa will not hide her from my fury."
"And my reward?"
the snake asked.
"You have your life as a reward," she said.
"That's true,"
the serpent hissed.
"I will deliver your message, Pulgara."
"Put it down," Aunt Paul told Silk. The small man bent and lowered his arm to the ground. The snake uncoiled from about his arm, and Silk released it and jumped back. The snake glanced once at him, then slithered away.
"I think that's enough rain, Paul," Wolf said, mopping at his face.
Aunt Paul waved her hand almost negligently, and the rain stopped as if a bucket had emptied itself.
"We have to find Durnik," Barak reminded them.
"He was behind us."
Geryon pointed back up the now overflowing stream. His chest felt constricted with a cold fear at what they might find, but he steeled himself and led the way back into the trees.
"Well, Smith is a good companion,"
Mandarallan said.
"I should not care to lose him."
There was a strange, subdued quality in the knight's voice, and his face seemed abnormally pale in the dim light. The hand holding his great broadsword, however, was rock steady. Only his eyes betrayed a kind of doubt Geryon had never seen there before. Water dripped around them as they walked through the sodden woods.
"It was about here," Geryon said, looking around. "I don't see any sign of him."
"I'm up here,"
Durnick's voice came from above them. He was a goodly distance up a large oak tree and was peering down.
"Are they gone?"
He carefully began climbing down the slippery tree trunk.
"The rain came just in time,"
he said, jumping down the last few feet.
"I was starting to have a little trouble keeping them up this tree."
Quickly, without a word, Aunt Paul embraced the good man, and then, as if embarrassed by that sudden gesture, she began to scold him. Durnick endured her words patiently, and there was a strange expression on his face. Chapter 21 Geryon's sleep that night was troubled. He awoke frequently, shuddering at the remembered touch of the mud men, but in time the night, as all nights must, came to an end, and the morning dawned clear and bright. He drowsed for a while, rolled in his blankets until Tenedra came to get him up.
"Geryon,"
she said softly, touching his shoulder,
"are you awake?"
He opened his eyes and looked up at her.
"Good morning. Lady Polgora says that you are supposed to get up."
Geryon yawned, stretched, and sat up. He glanced out of the tent flap and saw that the sun was shining.
"She's teaching me how to cook,"
Tenedra said rather proudly.
"That's nice,"
Geryon told her, pushing his hair out of his eyes. She looked at him for a long moment, her small face serious and her green eyes intent.
"Geryon?"
"Yes?"
You were very brave yesterday."
He shrugged slightly.
"I'll probably get a scolding for it today."
"What for?"
"Aunt Paul and my grandfather don't like it when I try to be brave. They think I'm still a child, and they don't want me to get hurt."
"Geryon,"
Aunt Paul called from the small fire where she was cooking,
"I need more firewood."
Geryon sighed and rolled out of his blankets. He pulled on his half-boots, belted on his sword, and went off into the woods. It was still damp under the huge oaks from the downpour that Aunt Paul had called down the day before, and dry wood was hard to find. He wandered about, pulling limbs out from under fallen trees and from beneath overhanging rocks. The silent trees watched him, but they seemed somehow less unfriendly this morning.
"What are you doing?"
A light voice came from above him. He looked up quickly, his hand going to his sword. A girl was standing on a broad limb just over his head. She wore a belted tunic and sandals. Her hair was a tawny color, her gray eyes were curious, and her pale skin had that faint greenish hue to it that identified her as a dryad. In her left hand she held a bow, and her right held an arrow against the taut string. The arrow was pointed directly at Geryon. He carefully took his hand away from his sword.
"I'm gathering wood."
"What for?"
"My aunt needs it for the fire."
"Fire?"
The girl's face hardened, and she half drew her bow.
"A small one," he said quickly, "for cooking."
"Fire is not permitted here,"
the girl said sternly.
"You'll have to explain that to Aunt Paul,"
Geryon told her.
"I just do what I'm told."
The girl whistled, and another girl came from behind a nearby tree. She also carried a bow. Her hair was almost as red as Sinedra's, and her skin was also touched with the color of the leaves.
"It says it's gathering wood,"
the first girl reported.
"For a fire. Do you think I should kill it?" "Santa says we are supposed to find out who they are,"
the red-haired one said thoughtfully.
"If it turns out that they don't have any business here, then you can kill it." "Oh, very well,"
the tawny-haired girl agreed with obvious disappointment.
But don't forget that I found this one. When the time comes, I get to kill it.
Garion felt the hair beginning to rise on the back of his neck. The red-haired one whistled, and half a dozen other armed dryads drifted out of the trees. They were all quite small, and their hair was various shades of red and gold, not unlike the color of autumn leaves. They gathered about Garion, giggling and chattering as they examined him.
"That one is mine," the tawny-haired dryad said, climbing down from the tree. "I found it, and Zara says that I get to kill it."
"It looks healthy,"
one of the others observed,
"and quite tame. Maybe we should keep it. Is it male?"
Another one giggled.
"Let's check and find out."
I'm male," Garion said quickly, blushing in spite of himself.
"It seems a shame to waste it,"
one remarked.
"Maybe we could keep it for a while and then kill it."
"It's mine,"
the tawny-haired dryad stated stubbornly.
"And if I want to kill it, I will."
She took hold of Garion's arm possessively.
"Let's go look at the others,"
the one called Zira suggested.
"They're building fires, and we'll want to stop that."
"Fires?"
several of the others gasped, and they all glared at Garion accusingly.
"Only a small one,"
Garion said quickly.
"Bring it along,"
Zira ordered, and started off through the wood toward the tents. Far overhead, the trees murmured to each other. Aunt Paul was waiting calmly when they reached the clearing where the tents were. She looked at the dryads clustered around Garion without changing expression.
"Welcome, ladies," she said.
The dryads began whispering to each other.
"Tenedra,"
the one called Zara exclaimed.
"Cousin Zara,"
Tenedra replied, and the two ran to embrace each other. The other dryads came out a little farther into the clearing, looking nervously at the fire. Tenedra spoke quickly with Zira, explaining to her cousin who they were, and Zira motioned for the others to come closer.
"It seems that these are friends," she said. "We'll take them to my mother, Queen Xantha."
"Does that mean I won't get to kill this one?"
the tawny-haired dryad demanded petulantly, pointing a small finger at Garion.
"I'm afraid not,"
Zira answered. The tawny one stamped away, pouting. Garion breathed a sigh of relief. Then Mr. Wolf came out of one of the tents and looked at the cluster of dryads with a broad smile.
"It is Belgorath,"
one of the dryads squealed, and ran to him happily. She threw her arms around his neck, pulled his head down, and kissed him soundly.
"Did you bring us any sweets?"
she demanded. The old man put on a sober expression and began rummaging through his many pockets. Bits of sweetmeats began to appear and just as quickly disappeared as the dryads gathered about him, snatching them as fast as he took them from his pockets.
"Have you got any new stories for us?"
one of the dryads asked.
"Many stories,"
Wolf told her, touching one finger to the side of his nose slyly.
"But we ought to wait so your sisters can hear them too, shouldn't we?"
"We want one just for ourselves,"
the dryad said.
"And what would you give me for this special story?"
"Kisses,"
the dryad offered promptly.
"5 kisses from each of us."
"Oh, I've got a very good story," Wolf bargained. "It's worth more than 5. Let's say 10.
8,
the little dryad countered.
"All right," Wolf agreed. 8 sounds about right.
"I see you've been here before, old Wolf,"
Aunt Paul remarked dryly.
"I visit from time to time,"
he admitted with a bland expression.
"Those sweets are not good for them, you know."
"A little bit won't hurt them, Paul. And they like them very much. A dryad will do almost anything for sweets."
"You are disgusting," she told him.
The dryads were all clustered around Mr. Wolf, looking almost like a garden of spring flowers. All, that is, except for the tawny one who had captured Garion. She stood a bit apart, sulking, and fingering the point of her arrow. She finally came over to Garion.
"You're not thinking about running away, are you?"
she asked hopefully.
"No,"
Garion denied emphatically. She sighed with disappointment.
"I don't suppose you'd consider it, would you? As a special favor to me?"
"I'm sorry,"
he said. She sighed again, bitterly this time.
"I never get to have any fun,"
she complained, and went to join the others. Selk emerged from a tent, moving slowly and carefully, and after the dryads had become accustomed to him, Durnick appeared.
"They're just children, aren't they?"
Geryon commented to Aunt Paul.
"They seem to be, but they are much older than they look. A dryad lives as long as her tree does, and oak trees live for a long time."
"Where are the boy dryads? All I see are girls."
"There aren't any boy dryads, dear," she explained, returning to her cooking.
"Well, then how... I mean..."
He faltered and felt his ears growing hot.
"They catch human males for that. Travelers and the like."
"Oh,"
he delicately let the subject drop. After they had eaten breakfast and carefully quenched their fire with water from the stream, they saddled their horses and started off through the wood. Mr. Wolf walked ahead with the tiny dryads still gathered around him, laughing and chattering like happy children. The murmuring of the trees about them was no longer unfriendly, and they moved through a kind of welcoming rustle from a million leaves. It was late afternoon by the time they reached a large clearing in the center of the wood. Standing alone in the middle of the clearing was an oak so large that Geryon could hardly accept the idea that anything so enormous could be alive. Here and there in its mossy trunk were openings almost like caverns, and its lower limbs were as broad as highways, and they spread out to shade nearly the entire clearing. There was about the tree a sense of vast age and a patient wisdom. Tentatively, Geryon felt a faint touch on his mind, almost like the soft brush of a leaf against his face. The touch was unlike anything he had ever felt before, but it also seemed to welcome him. The tree was literally alive with dryads, clustering randomly on the limbs like blossoms. Their laughter and girlish chatter filled the air like birdsong.
"Tell my mother you've arrived,"
the one called Zira said, and went toward the tree. Geryon and the others dismounted and stood uncertainly near their horses. From overhead, dryads peered curiously down at them, whispering among themselves and giggling often. For some reason, the frank, mirthful stares of the dryads made Geryon feel very self-conscious. He moved closer to Aunt Paul, and noticed that the others were also clustering around her, as if unconsciously seeking her protection.
"Where's the princess?" she asked.
"She's just over there, Mistress Paul," Durnick answered, "visiting with that group of dryads."
"Keep your eye on her," Aunt Paul said. "And where is my vagrant father?"
"Near the tree," Geryon replied. "The dryads seem very fond of him."
"The old fool," Aunt Paul said darkly.
Then from a hollow in the tree, some distance above the first broad limbs, another dryad appeared. Instead of the short tunic the others wore, this one was garbed in a flowing green gown, and her golden hair was caught in with a circlet of what appeared to be mistletoe. Gracefully, she descended to the ground. Aunt Paul went forward to meet her, and the others trailed behind at a respectful distance.
"Tia Pogra,"
the dryad said warmly.
"It has been so long."
"We all have our duties, Xantha," Aunt Paul explained.
The two embraced fondly.
"Have you brought us these as gifts?"
Queen Xantha asked, looking admiringly at the men standing behind Aunt Paul.
Aunt Paul laughed. "I'm afraid not, Xantha. I'd be happy to give them to you, but I think I may need them later."
"Oh, well," the queen said with a mock sigh.
"Welcome all," she greeted them. "You will sup with us, of course."
"We would be delighted,"
Aunt Paul said.
Then she took the queen's arm. "Can we talk for a moment first, Xantha?"
The two moved apart from the others and spoke quietly together as the dryads carried bundles and sacks down from the hollows in the tree and began to lay a feast on the grass beneath the broad limbs. The meal, which was spread out, looked peculiar. The common food of the dryads seemed to consist entirely of fruits, nuts, and mushrooms, all prepared without any cooking. Barak sat down and looked sourly at what was offered.
"No meat,"
he grumbled.
"It heats up your blood anyway," Silk told him.
Barak sipped suspiciously at his cup.
"Water,"
he said with distaste.
"You might find it a novelty to go to bed sober for a change,"
Aunt Paul observed as she rejoined them.
"I'm sure it's unhealthy," Barak said.
Tenedra seated herself near Queen Xantha. She obviously wanted to talk to her, but since there was no opportunity for privacy, she finally spoke out in front of them all.
"I have a favor to ask, Your Majesty."
"You may ask, child," the Queen said, smiling.
"It is only a small thing,"
Tenedra explained.
"I will need sanctuary for a few years. My father is growing unreasonable in his old age. I will have to stay away from him until he comes to his senses."
"In what way is Ranbarun growing unreasonable?" Xantha asked.
"He won't let me go out of the palace, and he insists that I go to Riva on my 16th birthday,"
Tenedra said in an outraged tone.
"Have you ever heard of such a thing?"
"And why does he want you to go to Riva?"
"Some foolish treaty. No one even remembers the reason for it."
"If it is a treaty, it must be honored, dear," the queen said gently.
"I will not go to Riva,"
Tenedra announced.
"I will stay here until after my 16th birthday has passed, and that will be the end of it."
"No, dear," the queen said firmly. "You won't."
"What?"
Tenedra was stunned.
"We have a treaty too," Xantha explained. "Our agreement with the House of Barun is most explicit. Our wood remains inviolate only for so long as the female descendants of the Princess Zoria stay with the Baruns. It is your duty to remain with your father, and to obey him."
"But I am a dryad,"
Tenedra wailed.
"I belong here."
"You are also human, and you belong with your father."
"I don't want to go to Riva,"
Tenedra protested.
"It's degrading."
Xantha looked at her sternly.
"Don't be a foolish child. Your duties are clear. You have a duty as a dryad, as a Barun, and as an imperial princess. Your silly little whims are quite beside the point. If you have an obligation to go to Riva, then you must go."
Tenedra appeared shaken by the finality of the queen's tone, and she sulked in silence after that. Then the queen turned to Mr. Wolf.
"There are many rumors abroad, and some of them have even reached us here. I think something momentous is happening out there in the world of the humans, and it may even touch our lives in this wood. I think I should know what this thing is."
Wolf nodded gravely. "I expect you should. The Orb of Ardua has been stolen from the throne in the Hall of the Raven King by Zadar the Apostate."
Xantha caught her breath.
"How?"
Wolf spread his hands.
"We don't know. Zadar's trying to reach the kingdoms of the Angoraks with the orb. Once he is there, he will try to use its powers to awaken Torak."
"That must never happen. What is being done?"
"The Alons and the Sindars are getting ready for war. The Arryns have promised aid, and Ranbarun has been advised, though he didn't make any promises. The Baruns can be difficult at times."
He glanced at the pouting Tenedra.
"Then it means war?"
the queen asked sadly.
"I'm afraid so, Xantha. I am pursuing Zadar with these others, and I hope we can catch him and get the orb back before he can reach Torak with it. If we are successful, I think the Angoraks will attack the West anyway out of desperation. Certain ancient prophecies are getting close to their fulfillment. There are signs everywhere, and even the twisted perceptions of the Grolem can read them."
The queen sighed.
"I've seen some of the signs myself, Bagarath. I had hoped I was wrong. What does this Zadar look like?"